We're a little early, but since everyone's here, get our underway. So we are reconvening the West District Plan hearings. We're now up to day six. We have the Hawthornden team, for Mr. Withnall. Please be seated. We'll retain a reasonable degree of informality in this occasion. Mr. Withnall, there is one preliminary issue I'd like to discuss with you before I invite you to present the case for the submitter. And that is how it is, given that the panel directed that all the evidence for submitters be tabled in on the 4th of April, that I received a brief evidence from Mr. Hopgood at 5 o'clock last night for the first time.
I wasn't aware that that was the case, so, and I apologise. There was a draft before the cut-off date, and I thought that the draft, but that had actually been lodged, been filed. So I do apologise about that.
Do
the hospital pass from the end of print?
Michael Nesbine, I'm the council assistant. I had to take some blame for that, and one of the reasons was that there was, if you like, some issues during the course of preparation of evidence which required further investigations and research and so on. The understanding was that expert evidence had to be filed by that date, but not non-expert evidence. Unfortunately, I haven't been involved in the submissions in front of QLDC. The ones we've been involved with involved DCC. Normally, the commissioners will accept the evidence on the day from the non-experts. And I do apologise again if that has caused you any embarrassment. We had understood that it wasn't required, and I had discussed the matter with the planners and so on, thinking it was fine to produce them on the day. But I acknowledged that it was very late when they were produced, certainly not for any other reason than I simply presumed only the expert evidence was required to be filed early.
I understand that there is an issue about different processes. And I suppose I have the minute of 25 January open in front of me, which says all evidence, including evidence representations from submitters who may only speak 10 minutes. Now, as it happens, the panel's not embarrassed, but the thing I want to check, because having read Mr. Hopgood's evidence, it's mostly background, but what I want to check, given that the council has completed its case, is as to whether it thinks it's prejudiced. Mr. Barr, what's the council's view?
Just filed a memorandum to that effect, as I understand it, sir.
Well, you better tell me what the memorandum says.
I'll get read myself. Essentially, we are happy to address issues in our reply.
Well, that's probably that's very helpful that the council takes that view. You'll understand, Mr. Whitnall, that I might have had considerable difficulty if the council had felt itself prejudiced.
Perhaps I can answer, sorry to that. I was unaware of that minute. I had reported to me only expert evidence was required, so again I apologise, it's been a lack of communication or something.
And you will chastise the appropriate people in due course.
Just to confirm, sir, with the council don't oppose. It does raise some issues because the affidavit isn't sworn. We're not Mr. Hopkins appearing, but I understand that he's here, so.
We'll come to the affidavit as we in a second. That's right. Just down to make sure I've got it.
Thank you.
on the basis that council doesn't oppose, and the panel, looking sideways, but certainly it's a thumbs up from my right, that's always a good sign, that the panel doesn't feel that it's unduly disadvantaged and we can handle the process. The only remaining issue is the technical issue that when you filed as a draft affidavit, but Mr. Hofford is present,
yes,
and will actually present the evidence.
Yes.
Well, I think that overcomes the technical issue. We might have a problem with submitting an unsworn affidavit if Mr. Hofford wasn't present.
Yes.
Yes. So we will accept that. I'll issue a note in due course, but it's likely it will be short and sweet. But the bottom line is we're really happy to proceed. We will receive Mr. Hofgood's evidence and listen with interest as he presents it. Mr. Withnall, you have, or Mr. Litt, and or Mr. Litt, you have the floor, and perhaps you'd like to tell me how you propose to run the case, since you have the entire day allocated to you. It's fair to say that I'm not anticipating we're going to take an entire day. In fact, I'd be stunned if we took the entire day, given that we have pre-read all of the material you've submitted, including the material we received last night. And so we don't need anybody to read verbatim. But with that precautionary tale, over to you.
Thank you, sir. Please forgive me, I feel totally unnatural sitting down.
If you feel the need to stand, then we can cope with that.
But if I get tired, I will sit down.
Yes, I can remember a long time ago appearing in court with a senior colleague who had an infirmity and told the Court of Appeal that he was unable to stand. And the late president said, "Oh, I see you're not prepared to stand up for your clients."
Well, as you are aware from reading the material, there are two discrete issues, although one has three sub-issues, and there are four witnesses. I do have a written synopsis of argument. I'm not sure if you have that.
Yes, we have had it, and we have read it.
Thank you. I wasn't proposing to read it. Simply proposing to summarise the key points from it verbatim, but it's what I'm going to say is covered there. Anyway,
happy for you to proceed on that basis, Mr. Whitman.
Thank you, sir. The first issue is the question of the location of the boundary of the outstanding natural landscape area. Although we addressed in the evidence as the issue of the outstanding landscape, outstanding natural landscape, and I get the words back to front because the High Court in the Man of War case actually reverses the order and says first you look at the landscape, then you look at the naturalness, and then you look at the outstanding. So it turns the words around completely. But so although we address it as a landscape, I do of course acknowledge that what we're really concerned about is where the boundary should be. And it's the submitter's case that the boundary should be at the top of the alpha fan, where it meets the Mount Alpha mountainside itself. And the reasons for that are simply boiled down to the simple proposition that it is not part of the Mount Alpha structure. It is distinct geologically. It is distinct geomorphologically. It is distinct in soil. It is distinct in vegetation. It is distinct in land use capability. And it is distinct in land use history. It has been farmed for the past 125 years as part of a larger farm. And in the course of that 125 years, it has been cultivated, ploughed, cropped, sown in grass, levelled in areas. It has an airstrip on it. It has virtually no indigenous vegetation apart from a few areas of scrub in some of the gullies which incise into the terrace above the boundary that was fixed in 2002. Apart from that, the trees are all exotics. The grass is introduced pasture. It has been irrigated. There is an irrigation race runs above it. There is underground irrigation reticulation in it. In short, it is a typical piece of farmland, quite distinct from the mountainside above it. It is also distinct in gradient, and it is the contact between the two geological structures, which is the point at which the gradient changes and the point at which everything else changes that I've enumerated. And that is a clearly demarcated natural boundary between two distinct formations and land use units. It is currently within the boundary of the ONL under the existing plan as a result of the decision in 2002 at which the owners, which I know as of today, were unfortunately not represented due to the fact that they were let down by their lawyer. That hearing did not have the benefit of hearing from the landowners and therefore the benefit of evidence as to the historical use of the land. It did not have the benefit of witnesses appearing before it who had actually been on the land but had made their assessment from the road. It did not have the benefit of geological evidence, which is very significant because it's clear from that decision of the court that it proceeded on the basis of evidence presented as to the geomorphology and geology by a landscape expert, which was unfortunately incorrect. Mr. own geological work on the land, but has had the benefit of geological work carried out since the 2002 hearing by and on behalf of the Regional Council, and is now able to inform the commissioners that what was treated as the fan in the 2002 hearing is in fact only a portion of the fan. The fan actually doesn't stop at the terrace where the RML boundary is currently drawn. It extends right down to the lake shore and includes considerable areas which have been subdivided in recent years, including Meadowstone, Sargent Drive, and others, and he deals with that in his evidence. So the truth picture is now before the commissioners. And the 2002 decision, in my submission to you, should be disregarded entirely. And it's for you gentlemen, as the commissioners, form your recommendation to come to your own view as to the appropriate place for the boundary.
On that brief discussion of the fan you've just given us, and agreed with Mr. Lever's evidence, and you describe how it goes down all the way to the lake, and there a substantial chunk of it effectively has been developed with houses all over it.
Yes.
Are you saying to us that because the entire feature can't be preserved, then there's no point in identifying a part of it that may not have been developed? So what I'm saying is, what's the relevance that some of it's been developed? Are you suggesting that we need to be thinking of protecting a whole feature or not at all?
Well, we can't turn back the clock, unfortunately. But I don't advance that as a ground in itself, but as a factor in the assessment. Because what we're really talking about is a remnant of a fan, which is being incorporated into a different landscape unit, a different geological unit, a different geomorphological unit. In terms of vegetation, land use aspect, everything else, it is part of that different landscape unit. It's not part of Mount Alpha. And the demarcation line, unfortunately, we can't quite see it from here because of those buildings, but the demarcation line is distinct. And I understand that commissioners have visited the land and been able to see for themselves.
It was very helpful getting up there.
Yes. I was there, well, I've been there, I was there a few years ago, but I was there yesterday. And it's quite informative. I think that's probably as much as I want to say in opening on that issue, unless anybody has any
questions. Well, I wonder if we should take these, as you say, there are two issues, and they're actually, although arguably they're interrelated, the basis of your argument is quite distinct. So I wonder if we should take canvas the O&L line issue before we go on to the balance of your opening. And the question I have to leave on is, or one of them, is that your evidence and your written opening emphasises the use of the land and the constraints the O&L line would place on the use of land. The issue that occurs to me is that, well, the rhetorical question perhaps, doesn't the Nutter War litigation tell us that the effect of the planning controls following from an O&L classification is in fact irrelevant to the decision as to where the O&L goes?
I'm not quite sure that I'm with you on the last part.
The question that my understanding of the ratio of of the man of war litigation is that the effect of an O&L classification in terms of the extent of restrictions it may or may not have on the use of land is irrelevant to the identification of where the O&L should be. And
yes.
So the question is, do you agree with that interpretation? And if you don't, you better tell me about it.
Well, I do agree with it, because if it is truly an O&L, then its protection is mandated. But our case says that this doesn't meet any of the... If you look at this piece of land, it doesn't meet any of the criteria for inclusion in an O&L, and therefore the boundary should be drawn so as to reflect the area which is truly an O&L, because to do otherwise dilutes and degrades the whole concept of protection on outstanding natural landscapes.
Now, I want to pick up on that point, because that was in fact where I was going to go next, that your evidence, and particularly from Ms. Ayres, focuses on the landscape tests of an O&L. Is it natural? Is it outstanding? Is it landscape? As you say, the Man of War inverted those tests and put them in sequence, confirming the way the Environment Court has traditionally done it. But the question is, I'm aware that in this district, for instance, there are many places that are in themselves unnatural, that form part of O&Ls, and the court has looked at the landscape as a whole. And so, for instance, I think about ski fields up on Treble Cone. Think of the floor of the Cadrona Valley, where you have a whole town in the middle of an O&L. And the court has said that's part of the O&L, because the landscape, the initial question is, what is the landscape? So I wonder whether the question as to whether it meet this particular area of land meets all the tests is the right question, and whether rather it's an issue of, do you push the boundary up the hill or down the hill? And as the court said in 2002, does it read as part of the upper landscape, or does it read as part of the lower landscape?
And that, in my submission, is the nub of it. And it is our submission that it clearly reads as part of the lower landscape. Take a photograph. I have some Google Earth page printouts. Everywhere one looks at it, one sees the correlation, the similarity between the lower landscape and the stark difference between it and the upper landscape.
Yes, I can tell you for the record that as we did our site visits, although we went on land, we also viewed your client's land from the top of the memorial, from Mount Zion, from the top of Sticky Forest. In fact, not quite all the points of the compass. I didn't go on the top of Mount Alpha and look down. But it is very visible, and I understand what you're talking about in the
it's a part of this. May I approach?
Oh, sir.
That is a continuum. This is totally different.
Now,
to draw, it's my suggestion, but to draw a line across there is quite arbitrary.
Predicate, I think we'll receive this as
more copy.
Is this whatever we're up to? What number we are through?
Question?
10.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
10 A, B, and C.
I'm not sure if that's actually the same one.
It's got to be one.
Yes. Or well, perhaps I'm confusing both.
Yes. It's also.
The old thing about a picture worth more than 1,000 words. But the eye is drawn to the mountain.
Now, the question this one I was going to discuss with Ms. Ayres is that the other impression we formed, and I put the inverse of this proposition to Ms. Melsop when she gave evidence last week, is that when you look at what has been termed the alpha fan, that is in fact, as you say, the upper alpha fan, on the Cadrona Valley side of Hawthornden Farm, there's a very clear delineation between the upper fan and the lower fan. On the lake side, there is no demarcation at all, because as you come down the Stony Creek fan, it's entirely continuous.
Yes.
And I wonder if the landscape witnesses are operating like ships in the night. One's looking at one half of the site and the other's looking at the other half of the site. And therefore, it's not actually very helpful because they're not engaging on the same basis. Like, and I can understand why they've done it, but that's just an observation and invite you to comment. And that way, you know, I should carry on that way, because Ayres can think about what her answer to the question is before she gives evidence.
Yes, well, both of Ms. Ayres and Mr. Leary take that very point, that there is no continuous demarcation between the upper part of the fan and the next terrace down, because the terrace only exists in places. In other places, it's been washed away, it's been had more material deposited on it, so that in fact it's a continuous slope from the top down through. In places, yes, there are the remnants of an old river terrace, which in itself, especially towards the Cadrona Valley end, has various gullies eroded into its face. So even where the terrace is still clearly visible, there are gaps in it. And perhaps that in itself emphasises the fact that this is a continuous land unit, both in terms of landscape, in terms of geology, in terms of land use.
Yeah, that's all right.
Thank you. Yeah, just a couple of questions from me. If we were being asked the question of determining the edge of an outstanding natural feature, I could very readily understand the edge that's proposed and the reasons for it. But we're not. We're being asked to consider an outstanding natural landscape, which in this case, I suspect, has a massive overlap with an outstanding natural feature. What I wanted to ask you was to help me understand how you would see the differences between an ONF, which we're not being asked to determine, and an ONL, which we are.
Well, the ONF, of course, is a distinct, discrete object. Whether it's a cliff, whether it's a whatever it is, it has clearly demarcated, well, usually it has clearly demarcated edges, although they may blend into the surrounding landscape. The landscape, I accept, has a wider connotation, but we're still looking at, does that part of the landscape really belong to and form an extension of the part of the landscape which is acknowledged as meeting the criteria? Or is it something which stands out as not part of that landscape at all, but part of a different landscape unit? And that's probably more a question for my landscape witness than for a layman such as myself. But certainly, so you asked me the question, that's my answer.
Yeah, I was hoping just if there was any particular legal considerations. I'll take your point.
Yeah.
Technical questions for the experts. My second question relates to and builds on the question you were asked by the chair around some of the examples of ONLs that include elements that might not have themselves be ONL, like a carved rotor township. The evidence that's been put in terms of the upper terrace of the Alpha Fan is that it doesn't of itself exhibit, at least in the view of your experts, the qualities that would justify of itself being included as an ONL. And so I wanted to just test with you, is it your case that every component of a proposed ONL has to individually satisfy that benchmark, or is there a bit of a grey area, overs and unders, where some individual elements might not have themselves passed muster, like a carved rotor township, but in the round the most appropriate response might be to still include those elements within an ONL. What are you actually putting them?
Well, the latter proposition is certainly supported by the case law. But it's important to remember that in some of those cases, and I think in Man of War itself, it was accepted that the non per se outstanding natural parts contributed to and formed a cohesive part of the wider landscape. So it's really a fact-specific issue. Does this land, to use the words of the 2002 decision, read as part of that,
yep,
or as part of that?
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that, because it seems to me there's really three options for us, if you might want to count as a Section 32 or whatever. One option is the ONL includes all of it. One option is that it clearly doesn't. The third option is that the upper terrace doesn't meet these things, but we might reach that point of saying in the round it might still serve the ONL. Is that a fair encapsulation of those?
I think that's a fair encapsulation of the options.
Yeah. Okay, look, thank you for coming. That's okay.
Commissioner Clare. I'll reserve my questions for these, because I think pretty much. Well, Mr. Whitman, I wonder if you should carry on with your second, which you've described in your opening as a second submission. I see as not even one page of your opening.
Yes, well, there is...
So we're expecting to be short.
It is controversial, because there is a measure of agreement between the witnesses on both sides of this issue, and there is a measure of disagreement. The key point that I want to make in opening on that is that in terms of the policies and objectives of the proposed plan, the issues which are raised against the rezoning of this land as proposed, or parts of it, are issues which are to be addressed in the context of a subdivision application. And that's in the plan as evidence. So they are not zoning issues. They are subdivisional issues. The policies and objectives make provision for them to be addressed at that time. And my simple submission is that they fall by the wayside. Transportation, for instance. Yes, the road land is not currently served by road, but so what? In subdivision, that's going to have to happen if subdivision is to occur. It's not currently served by water sewage, stormwater reticulation. Well, either it's going to have to be or it will be on site. But whatever. At the time of a subdivision for residential purposes, those issues will have to be addressed. But simply because they need to be addressed at that time, there's no reason against zoning them to an appropriate zoning now, because that's what planning is all about. Planning for the future.
Now, Mr. Whitmore, on that score, we've had this discussion with council witnesses at some length about the interrelationship between infrastructure, services, and zoning, and how much it's appropriate to leave to the subdivision process. I think the proposition I put to you, I should advise you, I sat on the hearing stream last year related to subdivision, and the very clear submission for the submitters on the subdivision section was I wouldn't say it was the inverse of the proposition you've just put to me, but it was close to the inverse, that if it was zoned, then all of the issues of having that many houses in that area of land will have been addressed, and it's a matter of detailed design and of the subdivision, and that there is not in law a development right for that number of houses, but all but. So as I say, in fairness to you, I should tell you that I have this rattling around in my head that I've received, let's say, not quite the inverse submission, but close to it in the context of the subdivision chapter.
Can I ask if that was in the context of rural residential or rural subdivision or in the context of urban?
Both.
Subdivision, both, yes. Well, I suppose what that tells us is that there is more than one way of looking at it. But as a matter of logic, any land which is apart from a dead flat land, and even that might have its problems, which is suitable for subdivision, is going to have to have appropriate design work to cope for with any possible natural hazards, anything of that kind. And it's going to have to be able to be serviced the appropriate structure, which comes first. It's a chicken and the egg situation. And I would say zoning comes first, and then subdivision is a matter of design. And that's where the council exercises control over subdivision by requiring satisfactory design and work done by the subdivider.
Yeah. I wonder whether the way through the intermediate path is not that we have to be satisfied that you have a design that is satisfactory in all respects, and you have for instance, a water supply and where it's going and what the capacity is, because those are matters for the subdivision process. But is the thing we need to be satisfied of that there is a solution,
yes,
that would produce a satisfactory result?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
That there might be more than one, but as long as there's one,
yes,
that's enough.
Yes.
And I think where the rubber hits the road in this particular case is, given the concerns in the landscape report that Ms. Ayers authored, that's attached to her evidence, that can we be comfortable that there is a landscape solution which achieves the outcomes that she identified were required in terms of, I think she sort of special treatment, I think that was her language, and that, first of all, there is a solution. So I think you said you agree with the first proposition in terms of the application of the look to landscape.
And that's really a matter of evidence.
Yes. So I should pursue that one with Ms. Ayers.
Yes.
Because there is also, and just for Mr. Ayers' benefit, there are the issue that Mr. Barr has that I want to discuss with him is whether the rural landscape provisions are the best means to ensure that actually comes to pass, because ultimately that's at the heart of the Section 32 question. That's more a statement of forewarning than a question.
I'm sure it's been taken on board.
Now, is that all we have on those developed? Commissioner McLeod, have you got any questions on the proposed development areas? The legal framework?
Yeah, I don't know if you can. So just to start by following on from where you left off with the chair, and just for the purposes of being crystal clear, your view is that if the land is given a zone enabling some form of development, forget rural or urban for now, and the zone might have a series of expectations within it about density and height and whatever, let's assume that to take advantage of that, a subdivision would need to be obtained. And of course, that might not always be the case, but for anything large scale, you'd assume it's hard to get around a subdivision. It's your view that even with a zone in place, a council could continue to refuse resource consent applications on the ground that it had no plans to fund infrastructure, and the owner of the zoned land simply had to wait until such time as infrastructure is in place or the developer has to front up and fund it. Have I got that right?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, I absolutely accept that. So, but the point is the council can effectively play infrastructure gatekeeper to keep refusing resource concessions until a satisfactory package of funding is in place, and a beholder of the zone simply has to accept that that's the reality. Because the council is telling us that as soon as the zone gets given, it faces irresistible pressure to find money for free infrastructure upgrades, and I think it's fair to say that is a big part of the council's position on a number of the rezoning requests.
I don't think that's a question which could be answered definitively in any. It has to be context specific. Generally, I accept that zoning is a signal from the council that this land is suitable for subdivision. But there must be constraints dependent upon the peculiar character of the land in question, which the council has a duty to address.
I suppose, though, the other thing I should advise you, Mr. Whitmore, is that in the subdivision context, the panel was the subject of a very large number of submissions that subdivision should be the default for subdivision should be a controlled activity status. The council staff position recommendation was ultimately that it should be restricted discretionary, but of course that panel is yet to make a decision because the position was pressed very strongly that it should be controlled in everything except the rural zone. And what would your answer be if the subdivision hearing panel concluded that those submissions were right and subdivision was a controlled activity? Is the other side of the coin that the onus on those seeking rezoning is significantly greater and vice versa?
I think I'd have to accept that. If you want something to be easy, then I think it's incumbent on the subdivider to address the issues that have to be addressed before it can be made easy. Now I'm trying to address this from a totally impartial point of view.
And equally,
by going down the restricted discretionary path, there is a bigger hurdle to jump. But you jump it at the time that you meet it. In other words, you cross the bridge when you get to it. But you can't have it both ways.
And similarly, the notified version, the subdivision chapter, yes, is that it's full discretionary, which would give more ammunition to your argument, although it's fair to say that by the end of the subdivision I'm hearing, I think, I'm not sure if there was any support for a full discretionary position on subdivision.
Yeah. But there are hurdles which have to be overcome, and the mechanism really dictates the point at which those hurdles have to be addressed and overcome.
To what extent are you familiar with and able to offer opinions on the National Policy Statement on urban development? That's fine. Mr. Rigo, you might want to have a copy available to talk with me about later on. Thanks, that's it.
Well, I think the evidence addresses some of those issues. But it's something I haven't caught up with yet.
Yeah, well, to be clear, it's no secret, I'm having a little bit of difficulty trying to understand what it actually means as well. No black market into there.
Yes, we'll be looking to Mr. Barrega for some assistance on that regard.
That's all, thanks.
I think...
Because it would appear that the interrelationship between zoning and subdivision is fairly critical to the... Is it anticipated that the subdivision chapter will be concluded before will we get an opportunity to see the result of that, whether it's controlled discussion?
No, they will be released together. It's an integrated package. The commissioner is really asking me a question.
I'm sorry, apologies.
So, to put it on the table so it's understood, my understanding is that the intention is that the this panel's recommendations on the submissions, if he is, will be released at the same time as the recommendations on the text of the plan. And one of the little challenges for this panel will be to ensure that its conclusions are integrated with the conclusions of the other panels on the text.
What a task.
Yes, that thought had occurred to me.
Come to me.
Yes, thanks.
I think that's all we're here really for. Your first witness, Mr.
I'll call Mr. Hopgood. Sufficiently familiar with it, then we can't
There'd be no giving it to me now.
I just want to say this. He's been waiting 15 years to address the issue of this line upon the land.
Well, Mr. Hopper, first of all, while Mr. Withnall feels more comfortable standing, don't feel the need that you have to stand too. We're very happy for you to sit down if you're comfortable doing that.
Oh, I'm quite comfortable standing.
So you're setting a precedent now. Mr. Hopper, no. Mr. Hopper, we have read your evidence. What we would be grateful for you doing is for you picking it, rather than reading it, verbatim, to pick the eyes out of it. We're like, as Mr. Withnall said, we understand you've waited 15 years to get this on your chest, but I suppose it's, to my mind, some of your evidence is background, and I can but other points that I can clearly understand that you want to express. So if you could pick the eyes out of it, that may be, you may find that difficult, but just leave it with you. To best convey the essence of your evidence to us.
In other words, you want a brief outline.
I think I want a brief outline, but if there are particular paragraphs, then I don't mind if you read them.
Well, perhaps if we don't go through them, what new purpose you could move on to something that's more important. It's rather difficult just to pick the eyes together straight away, like, you know, it comes in different forms.
Well, as I say, just do the best you can.
You don't want to read right through. I'm quite happy to read right through to you.
No, I don't think we do.
Just maybe commencing at paragraph 22.
Sure, certainly.
Okay, we'll start at 22. I'll tell you what I might have to think of that. water into a start, you don't mind.
Absolutely. Council's very free with its H2O.
Oh, that's it, yep. It's a bit of a problem through the country right now, isn't it?
You look out there, it's pretty low.
Very good. Okay. 22. We're all familiar, we've got the right page.
Yep.
Page 5. As indicated, our concern is that the placement of this line, which occurred without consultation or due consideration at the time of its placement in 2002, has and will continue to inhibit not only the farming operation referred to, but any future development that we may consider appropriate, having regard to our needs and the needs of the community to provide further rural residential developments. The most significant concern to us, which has resulted from the placement of the O&L through our farm, has been the serious level of uncertainty as to what is permitted beyond the O&L. In that regard, our farm manager constantly raises concerns regarding proposed fences, tracks, farm buildings, cropping, or tree planting. We constantly have to refer these inquiries to our legal advisors, or QLCD, for clarification. I am obliged to say that we have considerable difficulty ever getting clear answers to QLCD. To these inquiries, and it is my belief that the planners and council staff have some difficulty themselves in determining what is permissible and what is not. This has made the farming operation clearly difficult with much uncertainty. As a result of these uncertainties as to what can be legally carried out beyond the O&L, and the difficulties we foresee for any future development of the land, we have been very anxious and stressed and always concerned as to whether our farming operation would be curbed or curtailed because of the lack of clarity with regard to these issues. Of further concern to us is that the new proposed district plan provisions, which are intended to even more be stringent in more respects of the O&Ls, with further limits on the size of new farm buildings and requirements for further resource consents required in respect of the buildings exceeding over 100 metres square or 4 metres in height. It is proposed that also that subdivision and development is inappropriate in almost all locations. And to be successful, an application would have to be very exceptional. This would seriously curtail any future development plans we might have hope for in the future. We've had various approaches over the years to consider subdivisions to enable lifestyle blocks to be subdivided off the property. But clearly at the moment that is extremely unlikely. With regard to the second submission made by our company, namely the rezoning of the areas identified as A, B and C, in the evidence of Hannah Hayes, I can confirm that these areas will be very suitable, in our opinion, for the zoning change. These areas are situated on the southeastern slopes of the farm property, as identified on the plans provided. These areas are close to the adjoining residential and rural residential properties that border the farm. Especially Area A is adjacent to the proposed urban zoning and is immediately adjoining the proposed Wanaka urban growth boundary. The proposed district plan indicates an intention to include both large and low residential and low density residential zones along this boundary. In this area, there are already a number of buildings within view, including the existing farmhouse, the wool shed, the implement shed, and buildings. Area B, again, adjoins the proposed Wanaka urban growth boundary and is also very appropriate for future development because of its accessibility to Studholme Road and its easy contours, making it easy to connect up to existing proposed infrastructure and services. Area C is situated on the southeastern corner of the farm and is largely flat land comprising several large paddocks with a driveway leading to one of the developed dwellings on the property. This area is also very accessible to Studholme Road and would be relatively easy to subdivide and develop. This land adjoins land that has already been subdivided with similar density that proposed. I do not believe that any of these areas, if rezoned, would significantly affect the character and amenity of the property, especially from the public view. Right. Area C is in fact hidden from view except from Owen Hopkins' house and a few neighbours to the south. I am very conscious of the demand of rural residential and lifestyle properties in Wanaka, and as indicated, we have been approached in a number of occasions from interested purchasers. The proposed rezoning, in my view, is appropriate and practical in the interest of the community to provide and allow for further land for such development in a way that will not have adverse effects of the amenity value of the property and of the community in general.
Just by way of illustration, can you take a look at the photographs showing cropping on this upper terrace?
Yes.
When were they taken?
Oh, they were taken back last year. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm. Would you look?
I'd like to produce those to them. And then the members of the panel,
sorry, no,
they have some questions for you.
Did you take the photos, Mr. Hopkins?
Yes.
Got exhibits, we've got two new exhibits. What number are we up to, Steph?
12, 13.
Yeah. Lucky yourself.
We've got the historical ones, the horses on them.
Well, that's right. As you know, Mr. Weston, we're not bound by the rules of evidence. I'm perfectly willing to accept that in days gone by,
well,
possibly before.
Mr. Studholme sitting on the side of the horse.
Possibly in the days of Mr. Rockwood's youth.
What was that?
You were on a horse.
How would I class that? I better not say.
Historical interest.
Yes, we'll accept that too as exhibit 14.
Can I get a copy of that?
You want the other one here?
That's great.
That's a great
picture. I have to confess at the time when we had the site visit, by way of courtesy, I went to introduce myself to Owen.
Oh, okay.
Just to say that we were heading up. And it was one of the comments he made, which was when the Studholmes turned up, that the only limitation on their getting a land was the amount of fencing that they could purchase. They could have anything they wanted as long as they could fence it, which I wish those days were still with us.
Those days are long gone.
Yeah, long gone.
Yeah. And you could do something on your property too. Other than that.
Now, Hopkins, if you feel more comfortable at any point, by all means,
Commissioner.
I'm interested in areas A, B and C, and specifically how they were identified. Was that just something you just asked your experts to tell you what they thought, or was there a suggestion to them?
We've been trying to plan this for years, trying to see what we're going to do with the place. You know, as the encroachment comes in, you know, when you're going to look around and do something, either that or get swamped.
Well, following on from that, the proposal and the submission is for areas A and C to have one type of zone.
Yeah.
And for area B to have a slightly denser zone.
Yeah.
Again, is that something the experts have identified, or is
I think you can take it for experts, or me, or anyone layman. You can look at that situation as that that one there is hidden from all views, you know.
You mean that one being
B. We're speaking of the rural residential, aren't we?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
So what I was going to get to was, if we found ourselves in a position where we agreed that Area B was suitable for some form of development, but it should be the same as A and C rather than denser, what would your view on that be?
What would my line be on it?
What would your view be on it?
Well, I could put it this way, perhaps, that the town boundary is next to right to the next to the growth boundary, isn't it? Yeah, right there. If I go out 4 km, say, towards Cadrona Road, we're looking at a rural residential that's 4 km away from the growth boundary. And, I think in all fairness, us asking for something that's right on the boundary, like it's rural residential, I think, but it's appropriate.
The counter point to that, Mr. Hopgood, might be that in terms of the robustness of drawing a line that is an urban growth boundary, that it might actually be easier to justify rural residential development 4K away than it is 4 feet away, because of the extent to which in effect, you're blurring the boundary. Now, that's a planning issue, and I'll ask Mr. Edgar to comment on it. But I'll just throw that out there, and I can understand your point of view, but do you, if you have any comment, so that was just my immediate reaction, because I can see you can run those arguments both in both directions.
Perhaps I should go back a few years to the process of the 2020, if you're familiar with that. It's probably that long ago. I don't know, but there was a process set up for 2020 in 2002, I think, or 2004. There was a conciliator set up. This is by the council itself. And this is to get the views of the public to what direction we should be going in, you know. So, and we're quite familiar with it. I am. There was four sittings, like, you know, they had workshops. And we went along to them, and we listened to all this stuff, and it was coming through that what, in the council, said, what you people want to say and what you say we're going to do. Well, I haven't heard much about 2020 in recent times. In fact, I think it's just about defunct. It just didn't work. Like, all the properties they did specifically say that near the town centre and out, we're going to get them to be able to develop.
Well, what's really happened is our farmers forgotten about. I've been up in front of their whole quorum over in Queenstown and asked them about it before the plan started. I said, well, we're closest town to the, to that area. And completely ignored us. And we've been approaching it for years with no satisfactory answers or anything. So that's about it.
Mr. Hopgood, in terms of concern you have about residential development coming up right to your farm boundary, it's now his own, yes, and the problems that have when basically town people want to complain about ordinary rural activities.
Correct.
And it's happening all over the country, of course. Everyone wants to live in the country, but no one wants the country to come to them. The thought I had was that, is this the if you can't beat them, join them? Because it seemed to me that that if you're going to have a whole lot more residential activity literally on the farm, that's going to pose even more difficulties for you.
Not really, no. I think it's the choice of the council of what direction they're going to go. How they determine what you do, see. They start in the north and we've got to go tell what they say. That's what's happened. We've been pushed into a corner, in other words. We're surrounded in houses. So what are you going to do, sink or swim?
And I suppose the other question is, if your development plans are successful, will what you have left be a viable farming unit?
Well, it's not going to make really much difference until you get to a subdivision situation anyway. Like, just because you're zoning it doesn't mean to say you can't run any farm. It's just going to be the same. We'd approach that matter, I think, when we get to it.
And in terms of the concern about the practical effect of an O&L classification on your operations, is it farming you're concerned about, the constraints on farming, or constraints on any other developments of the land you might want to undertake?
Mostly on the farming. This point, but it inflicts a monetary injury upon us as well. At the end of the day, as you can see, I don't know whether I should get into it, but I can give you many examples within this one ward where a lot of people have been at disadvantage in many ways, monetary. They can't go ahead and do anything. It's really reached the point now that something has to be done about it.
And in terms of something having to be done, did you make submissions on the rules that apply within an O&L?
What was that?
Did you, your company, make submissions on the rules that apply within an O&L?
Did we?
Yeah.
Well, they're not mine. I didn't make the rules. No, Scott made the rules.
Okay, I'll ask Mr. Edgar that question.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah, for me,
kind of interesting. The question I've asked a few times, and I'm actually quite gratified to see Mr. Edgar actually addressing it, but is the capacity of the soil. I mentioned the same to Owen when I was up there. The it's quite a fertile farm that you've got. It's quite a productive farm. Would you agree with that?
Well, the difference is where we are in up above on the so-called outstanding landscape area. We put fertilizer on ours, as you'll notice, and that's why we grow stuff. Up the top, they don't. It's run as dry land.
One of the concerns I have is that we do seem to be losing a lot of fertile land to buildings and development, and I was just wondering how you felt about, which follows on from the discussion about the productivity of the farm moving forward and the viability, but just wondering about losing the fertile soils.
Well, I think you could have to look at a lot of other areas within the district of which where it's happened. That, you know, you can look at North Lake, for instance, if you want to. That's flat land way out there. It's full of houses now. Yeah. And I may add that it's about 2.5 times away from the town centre. There's something for the town planners to look at. We're only about a K away. And when I did approach the council on that matter, they didn't want to know. You know, well, in all fairness, they bought the 2020 situation. Oh, I wouldn't be standing here today telling you about it. Wouldn't have to, because our farm would have been incorporated in within the town plan. That's, you know, that's about it.
Yeah, and one other thing, just with regard to the reverse sensitivity issues that you mentioned, is it your understanding that you'd be looking at putting some sort of controls over if consent was granted for the development of ABNC in terms of how the operation of the farm could operate outside of that with no...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's fine, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hopkush. Appreciate your time. Wonder if we'd take the morning tea adjournment before we go to get into the next witness. So we'll adjourn until...
Well, something perhaps I could mention is that maybe the panel can help me in that situation regarding what you can do and what you can't do.
Well, yes. I think you need to ask Mr. Edgar that question.
Yes.
So we'll adjourn until 25 to 12.